There are over 3,000 shows performing throughout the month of August here at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. But how do you get a show here? And more importantly, how do you make it stand out? Let's find out. I'm Jamie Boddy, and this is The Business of Show Business. A lot happens behind the scenes to help a show hopefully have success here at Fringe. And a key part of that is PR, not only during the Fringe, but in the lead up and after. It's all about building that buzz, so hopefully the show has a second life. So I'm sat down with arguably the queen of PR at the Fringe. It is Chloe Nelken.
Thank you.
No worries. So obviously you have a fantastic roster here at the Fringe, and you're known for championing kind of emerging work as well. So first of all, why is PR so important for a show at the Fringe?
There is just so much competition at the Fringe, as you can see by walking around, the amount of people that fly you, the posters that are everywhere, restaurants become venues, the main venues obviously open. So without PR, I think it can be really hard to cut through that noise. And that's not to say you can't have a successful Fringe. If you can't afford PR, of course you can, and there are ways to do it, but PR just helps cut through and get access to the journalists.
When is the best time for a show to meet with PR to the Fringe? I think people forget, and then it's panic.
Yeah.
But you've got to kind of plant those seeds. So when is the best point for a show to meet you?
I mean, we've already got shows in touch about next year, which is very flattering. So we'll probably start meetings from September to October. We aim to finalise our main roster of shows by the end of February.
Wow.
So actually, it comes around quite quickly. Fringe planning starts really early. So while I don't currently want to be thinking about next year, I am always grateful when artists send in their scripts early and we have those early chats rather than it being a manic last-minute rush.
And if we kind of take a look behind the curtain of PR, obviously, because a lot of it is relationships with journalists, broadcasters, networks. So I guess you have to almost partner a show potentially with that publication or journalist. Is that kind of how your mind works with it?
I mean, good PR is always about matching the right show to the right journalist and finding the angle that's appropriate for them or the show that you think they'll enjoy. Again, with this level of competition, that's more important than ever. And also during the Fringe, some shows will fly in the way you want and some shows won't. And as a PR, you have to be able to call in certain favours. So it really is all about, okay, what journalist can I text this morning? Because this show really needs a bit more love. So of course, relationships are paramount, and that's why people hire PRs.
Again, a lot of people I spoke to on the mile when they're flying, talking about the show, and it's almost panic stations. So is the lead-up coverage for a show equally important? Maybe not as much as when you're here, but obviously trying to lay or plant those seeds ahead of the Fringe.
Yeah, 100%. I think the majority of ticket buyers start thinking about the Fringe in July. Of course, some people will buy for the big name comedians or the big acts further in advance, but really it gets to July and press as well as audiences subtly go, oh my God, the world's largest arts festival is in a month. So that's when all of the roundups and the interviews in advance are really important for people to see something multiple times. So then they book their tickets. That's not to say it stops during the Fringe, because it most definitely doesn't. And our days normally start at 6:30, emailing journalists, following up on outstanding reviews, all of that. But really, if you haven't had anything in advance at the Fringe and you have a PR, that wouldn't be a great place to be.
Yeah, your team were amazing at responding. I emailed them. I'm like, why are you replying at 1 a.m? You should be asleep. But obviously that relationship with your PR is so important. So what would make your life easier if a Fringe show comes to you?
During the Fringe, I think what makes our life easier is giving us all the correct assets. So for example, production photos, the thing that makes me pull my hair out, we're always asking our acts to get them done in dress or in tech or on the first show, because of course, reviewers want amazing new production photos to run with their images. So I think remembering if your PR gives you advice on something, they're probably saying it for a reason. And you know, we've got one show now going, oh God, you were right, we'll get them done next week. But next week will be week three.
Yeah.
So I think listening to your PR and also trusting your PR, you've brought that person on to be part of the team. So obviously we'll always get artists who are anxious going, oh, can you update us on this? Actually emailing your PR every morning and going, we need to get The Guardian in. Is probably not going to make you their favourite show. They've obviously tried.
Yes. And on the flip side, as a journalist, I know when I'm trying to file a story, news, review, otherwise, not having photos will delay when it goes up, which could impact, not saying it will impact sales necessarily, but obviously if you're building buzz, you want to keep that momentum.
Of course, but also you surely want to show people what your show looks like. That's always what blows my mind with it. I'm like, it's amazing you've got a phenomenal poster, but that doesn't tell anyone what your production actually looks like. And also there's such a range of photographers. So I get budgets are tight. You know, budgets at the Fringe are a horrible thing that we talk about all the time.
Yeah.
But you can get somebody for not very much, or if you want to go ultra professional with a very experienced snapper, you can get something different. So there's always a level that works for you.
So obviously PR would lead people to a show, and if it's quote unquote five stars, great show, people will stay and keep coming back, recommend it. What if a show is not performing positively and they're like, I just need PR? It's hard to say, straight down the camera as well. Sometimes shows are not always necessarily ready for the industry right now, or they're not where they need to be. So if a show's not doing well, can PR fix it?
Probably not. I mean, if there's a huge news hook or somebody famous or something like that, then yeah, you'd probably get PR, but it's not necessarily going to fix it if the show's not ready. You know, fundamentally, if a show is getting 2 or 3 stars, PR can't make wave a magic wand and get someone to give it 5 stars.
Yeah.
So there's always outlets that you can talk to or interviews you can get, but I think what's important to remember is PR is about profile.
Mm-hmm.
And you always hope that profile leads to ticket sales, but there's never the guarantee that you get a top PR on and then you sell out your run. Yeah. I wish it worked like that. My life would be so much easier. Yeah. But it's just sadly not. PR is about profile raising.
Do you spend time? Because also a 3-star isn't bad.
Not at all. A 3-star at the Fringe as well is a great review, actually. Reviewers at the Fringe tend to not be harsh, but they're not doling out 5 stars every day. So I think sometimes people go, oh my God, it's 3 stars. And we have lots of chats with artists going, no, 3 stars is great. Let's read through this review line by line and look at your pull quotes. And actually, look, there are some constructive things that you can work on after the Fringe. But you've got flashes to put on your poster.
And what would maybe help a show that's having a positive momentum have life after the Fringe?
Make sure you invite the right people. So whether that's, you know, programmers, bookers, whoever it is, future more commercial producers, make sure you get your great press up on your posters. Yes. Almost don't be complacent. You've had these amazing reviews. Use them. Like, the reviewers have picked your show. So put up those flashes and put up the stars. And also make connections with other artists. For me, I think the Fringe is such a special place in terms of the artists and the programmers from all over the world who are here. So use that.
Is it beneficial to you, obviously, not to step on your toes, but if a show is out that they're flying their network in, they also need to do some work as well. It's not just, here, you're going to fix everything for me. Should they kind of work in collaboration with you?
Not in terms of press, unless they've specifically been told to. So some PRs, including us, run lower level packages where they support more emerging artists, and then we work in collaboration with our artists. But if we're offering a full service PR package, we don't want our artists going to talk to journalists. And we're really clear with them about that. And of course, you know, someone may bump into you on the street and you may go, oh, that's great, send me the information. But then we want them to email us and say, we met this nice journalist called Jamie, and can we talk to him?
No, that's great, because I think, yeah, again, some people sometimes there's that battle as well, because it's maybe comes from a place of desperation. They're like, I just need as many bums and seats as I can. So before I let you go, because you're about to speak on a panel, again, she is pounding the streets of the Fringe. If someone listening or watching is thinking, right, I need to do Fringe 2027, what's one actionable tip they can do maybe to help their show build momentum?
Maybe not actionable, but the thing I always say to artists is, why are you doing the Fringe? And if you don't have an answer to that, then maybe now isn't the moment to do it. So whether it is to get great press, whether to get booked for a tour, whether to bring a producer on board, I think with costs as they are today, the Fringe, while it is fun, you can't just do it for fun unless you happen to be sitting on a spare 50 grand. Mm. So I think it's before you start on that path and start your actions, know why you're doing it and what you want to get out of it.
Great. And then where can people find you? Again, I don't want everyone just to email them out. I've got an idea of a show, Chloe.
No, you do. We'll always chat to people.
But how can people find you if they need PR coverage?
So we are Chloe Nalkin Consulting. So we're on Instagram and all the socials, and our contact details are on the website. So people can just drop us an email and we're always really happy to chat.
Being discoverable here at the Edinburgh Fringe is key. I bumped into 2 show creators whilst flying, so let's find out the success of their show and how they got here. First of all, let's do elevator pitch, proper business style. First of all, name, straight down the barrel, tell me your show.
Alex Moneypenny, co-writer of The Shocking Truth About Flat Earth.
Adam Tuffrey, co-writer of The Shocking Truth About Flat Earth.
The show is about a woman who believes the Earth is flat and is out to prove it. She's grieving her mother, she sort of falls into an online conspiracy rabbit hole, basically gets mistaken for a flat earth influencer at a convention, then goes to prove that the earth is flat.
Catchy tunes, hilarious script, and 0 scientific credibility.
Yes, there you go.
I think that was directly off that.
Interview done. So talk to me about getting your show here. What has the timeline been? I think this is the final product. People see Edinburgh Fringe, oh, it's easy. It's really not. What has been your time frame getting you here?
Yeah, well, we started the idea probably 3.5 years ago, and maybe we were writing that for about 6 months, and then took the leap of faith, which is really hard to do. We are learning actually to just get stuff out there and get it in front of an audience, test it, workshop it. So we had maybe 2 or 3 workshops before taking it to the Riverside Studios, which was great. So that was January 2025. And then as a result of that, some producers, I think that's where we met.
25, oh my gosh.
And actually Wolverhampton Grand came to that showing, I think. And then we did another self-funded, we raised £12,000 through crowdfunding. We begged and borrowed from every family member, dead or alive. And we then put on a production of this, at the Cockpit in Marylebone. And yeah, Wolves saw it again. They loved it. And their vision for it was to bring it to Fringe. We'd never done Fringe before, so had no idea what to expect. We still don't know what to expect every day we wake up. But Yeah, is that right? That's kind of how it got here. And so Wolverhampton Ground were the ones to take a punt, really.
Let's talk about the wider marketing of the show. So obviously social media, your cast members are sharing. Obviously flyering is essential here. You've smashed it with this. Talk to me about flyering, highs and lows. It's needed.
Our marketing team, shout out. Because you sort of go, oh yeah, circular flyer, that's a good idea. It has gone down such a storm.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. To be honest, we're sort of learning as we go. Like, we got here and, you know, you're trying. I think I accidentally called someone. I think I said to someone, you look like you might be a flat earther, which didn't go down very well. And I was sort of learning as we go. But it's you sort of learning the pattern, learning who to approach. We're also probably like learning who our show is for. We sort of had an age range in a sense, but really going, you know, if you look at a crowd, you go, actually, I think they'd enjoy it. Yeah. It's really interesting. But to be honest, also because we wrote here the first couple of days, to be totally frank, were pretty horrible because there's a lot of people just going, I think someone turned around to me and went, absolutely not. And you're like, cool, just 3 years of my life.
But it is tough.
But we got very lucky with these flyers.
And obviously, as you said there, being strategic, noticing who may look like they're going to see your show, who's maybe got 20 flyers in their hand already.
Yeah.
Do you think the recommendation word of mouth is just as important as maybe someone just smashing it on social media?
I think so. I think we're still working out what the balance is. I guess it depends on the show as well.
Yeah.
I think if it's a sort of underground comedy type thing, maybe word of mouth is great. With this, I think we need to lean more into social media and flyering. For our show, and speak for us, I think it's a combination of loads of different things. I think word of mouth, though, is king.
Yeah, I think so. And actually, we have seen that in ticket sales. And also so that the audience know what they're expecting when they come to the show. It is a comedy musical. And actually, when you go to Book of Mormon, you know it's going to be funny. Yeah. And we're finding now that in the last couple of days, audiences, even at 2 o'clock, are ready to laugh and enjoy the show, which is great. So I think word of mouth slowly is really helping.
Well, I'm not obviously going to ask you to show me your payslips, but it costs a lot to be here. So what are some of the costs? Again, you don't have to go into numbers right now, but what are maybe some of your outgoings? You've got like cast, venue, accommodation. Can you maybe give
a
snapshot?
I'm happy to go into numbers if you are.
Yeah.
No pressure.
Yeah.
No. Exclusive.
I'm genuinely.
It's so good.
People should know. Right?
They do, and I think we do it. But do you go in debt? What's your baseline? So if you're happy to, but do what you're comfortable.
Yeah. I mean, for a start, we are so grateful to Wolverhampton Grand. They have probably put in close to six figures into this, which is without them we wouldn't be here, quite frankly. As we said, we self-funded £12,000 in crowdfunding to make the last version happen. Accommodation for the cast was about £6,000. Our Airbnb, which your mum has spent more time in than me, I think, has cost probably about £5,000. Obviously, I've asked favours of musicians to record on the tracks. We've called in so many favours. I mean, we reckon that we're probably about £17,000, £18,000 in the red to get to this point today from writing to now. And that's not a woe is me. That's just part of the process. It could have been much worse. And that was something that we were really lucky to be able to do. It's not cheap.
Yeah.
Is that about right?
I'm also saying, you know, obviously, we're taking a break from our jobs. Adam's a teacher. I make content as well, actually. And I've spent like a sort of a time away and all the living expenses and, you know, getting up and the 15 coffees you have a day. So, yeah, it's a lot.
And thank you so much for being honest, because I think we glamorise Edinburgh Fringe, and it obviously it's the best place to be in August, it really is, but there does come that cost physically, mentally, financially. What do you wish you had known before coming, or what advice would you give to anyone watching thinking they want to come to the Fringe?
Goodness me. Firstly, do it, because I think like, we certainly, I'd speak for us, like, I think we've learned just putting yourself out there, like, even if it's the worst experience, you get out there, you meet people, you make connections, and you have conversations that you wouldn't otherwise have. But yeah, it is tough, but I think in the end, rewarding, like, and not to sort of sound like a, you know, it sounds like a line, but the cast are so great, working with people you love is so great, that it is worth it. Like, money, you know, we're in a fortunate position with Wolves, but, you know, money is something that, for me, comes and goes. It's you just spend it, you bring it in, you can work for a little bit, you take a month off, you come back in. So I would just say do it. But it is really hard.
And it's the people that you're with as well. So I know you touched on it there, but obviously, really fortunate I get to write with one of my best friends, but the cast have been flyering for 2-3 hours a day. Then they do the show. There's no day off. Well, there's one day off in about 4 or 5 weeks. The producers, we're lucky we have a good relationship with them. The people is, we've been really lucky, and some thought has gone into that as well. But yeah, to make sure that you're with good people is, it's been a game changer for us.
So let's hope the show has a long life. It will. If someone misses it in the run here and they're listening or watching this back in the future, How can they find the show?
Number one, Spotify. There's four really great tracks on there, which gives you a really good flavour of what the show is. So please check us out there. A guy called Sam Featherstone mixed and mastered those, pulled in favours again from the same musicians that really kindly recorded that. So yeah, check the tracks out on Spotify. You're probably best place to talk about social media because your girlfriend has smashed it and knows way more than we do.
She's also not slept the entire... She's out of content.
Genuinely, yeah, she's been amazing. Thank you, Sophie. At Shock and Truth Musical is the handle. And we hope to produce it further, obviously with the backing of Walls. We're sort of having conversations at the minute about what that looks like.
Yeah.
I think, you know, maybe this isn't the conversation for it, but there's so many routes and avenues that you're sort of like, it's a little bit overwhelming at the minute of what to do next. But whatever that is, we so believe in the show. And yeah, we would love people to come to.
Amazing. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
So The Fringe, it's fun, but it's hard work. So I'm sat here with someone who is back for a second time. Emily, welcome back. Quickly show us in an elevator pitch. Hold up your leaflet straight down the camera. Tell me about your show.
In my show, Furniture Boys, all of my ex-boyfriends are furniture. Lamps, shelves, chairs, couches. Why are the boys furniture? You have to come to the show to find out. It starts off funny and clowny, but there's a deeper meaning as to why.
So let's talk about creative journey, because I think The Fringe looks fancy if one wants to be here.
Yeah.
But it's hard work to get here.
It is hard work.
So what was your journey from creation to come in first time and then what brought you back second time?
Yes, well, my show really started 15 years ago, the seed of the idea, as a spoken word poem. I was a spoken word poet. I performed around the world. Then I was just writing for the page. I kept writing about furniture and relationships. It grew and grew. I wrote the show. I did it first in New York. Then I did some smaller Fringe festivals, so there were many iterations of it. I developed it before bringing it the first time. Last year, it went really well, so successful. By the end of the Fringe, we got a 4-star Guardian review. We started getting some momentum, so we decided to ride that wave, ride that momentum, bringing it back this year.
I think that's key, because I think a lot of performers, they spend time getting here.
Yeah.
It's an incubator. It's a petri dish of like chaos.
Yeah.
And then it's like, I need to relax after. Yes, you need to heal, but you need to keep that momentum. So what did you do to keep that momentum? Was it find a PR? Was it emailing people, social media? How did you keep the buzz?
Yes. I mean, it was building on the connections we made last year. We met someone who just became our friend and then joined as a producer. We were at a panel where we first saw Chloe, now our PR. So we really used the genuine connections that we made last year, building on those for this year. We came back with the same venue, Underbelly, but now we're at a bigger theater, 90 seats, a 2:30 time slot. So yeah, it was really that feeling of riding what we created last year. We were really happy with it, but there was more to build.
Let's talk networking then. I think people think that's quite an icky word,
but
it's so important whilst here. Do you have any tips for anyone whilst they're here? Maybe to build collaboration or network?
Yeah, well, I'm the first to be like, ugh, networking, that sounds horrible. But when I was here last year, I found it really is just genuinely connecting to people. And you're not networking just for the sake of it. Like, you have something you've created that you're really proud of that you want to share with them. And you genuinely want to hear what have they created? What are they interested in? What have they seen? So I do feel if it comes from that genuine place of connection, which I think everyone is starving, craving in this world right now, you know, then it doesn't feel icky. It feels genuine.
So glad you said that. I lecture at quite a lot of universities. I'm like, it's like, if you know what you're selling, who does the same thing, what you love? It's not awkward. It's you're just talking about the same passions.
So I also, I teach 18-year-olds. I'm a professor of writing at university. So it's like, I mean, from a maybe slightly different perspective, but I feel like 18-year-olds in today's day and age also are like really looking for that connection. And I'm also trying to show them how writing and art can bring us to that. And that's a huge thing that the Fringe really embodies.
Yeah.
It's amazing to be a part of.
Let's talk marketing as well, because obviously all the cameras for this one there. There's cute little chair. You've got your phone.
They're also phone stands.
Oh my gosh. So cute like that.
Yeah.
Yes. So it's no longer just I do a show. There's a lot of social media. Talk to me a bit about your marketing or your strategy.
Again, it is genuine. I love collecting tiny chairs and tiny furniture. I have my tiny chair necklaces here. I have a collection of tiny chairs at home. So our marketing really came out of the genuine question of the show. Why are the boys furniture? Why the chairs? What does a chair represent? So it was quite natural. And I do feel like if you're not thinking of it as like a gimmick, but you're thinking of it genuinely, how can you present your show to the world in maybe a more tangible way, like this tiny chair? But yeah, just go with your own creativity and what is genuine to your show.
But I stopped on the mile with your flyer in. Yeah. I stopped when they've got a sandwich board, they've got a circular flyer, they've got merch, they've got props. And I think this has been quite a conversation point, have you found?
It has, yeah. People will come up to us instead of us coming up to them because they want to know about the tiny chairs. Or people have like complimented my tiny chair necklaces.
There's multiple tiny, I just noticed.
Yeah, there's a bigger one as well that I'm not wearing. So yeah, people have come up to us because of the tiny chairs, and that's cool too. And it is a conversation starter. We ask people like, what kind of furniture are you? What kind of furniture do you want to be? Yeah.
I thought I should have got your tiny chair. Disgusting, you have to sit on a full size chair. I'm so sorry. I should have got your tiny
chairs of all sizes. Like, these are good for the marketing, but on our actual stage, we have furniture of all sizes. And I love these chairs. They're fun colors.
Yeah. Let's quickly talk about overheads and not going too grander into it. But what are some of the outgoings? Just so people are aware, because again, they think, I love this show. Everyone will love it. Let's go. But obviously, it's not just that. So again,
it is a ticket split. I know it's different at every venue, but you sign a contract with your venue. Yeah. You're aware of the split, and you have some upfront costs that you put into that. But like, we've actually made quite a bit so far. Like, if we sell well, we're selling out a 90-seat theater. So it's going pretty well.
That's great. And I think, again, there's a strategy. Obviously, you came... What was your venue capacity last year?
75.
So that's a nice increment to go up. Because, again, I think sometimes you want that big venue. But actually, is it better to be slightly smaller? You can sell out. It builds that buzz. It's scarcity. They can't get a seat.
Absolutely. Yeah, you get to be on that sellout board. We're already on there this morning, fourth on the sellout board on a Monday morning. Ooh. And that feels good.
Did you have to serve in your tiny chair to write on the board?
I mean, I'm quite tall. You don't have to write on the board. They write it for you. But I did have to kind of go on my tippy toes to point to it. Which is exciting.
And I know you've got shows today, so I'll be very quick. Last couple questions. Coming internationally, what advice would you give? Because again, this is a smorgasbord of international performance. What advice would you give to anyone coming from overseas?
Yeah, I mean, it's challenging and it is expensive. It's a huge investment. You go for it. Like, you want to get the most out of the experience, and you have to do so much. Like, even if you're hiring flyers, no one is going to fly or better for your show than you, you know. Again, making those connections, no one's going to do that for you. You want to get out there, meet people, go to shows, but also go to panels, go to events where you can meet other artists, where you can have a conversation. And then we really don't have anything like this in the US, so it is a fantastic opportunity, and we're just trying to soak up every moment of it.
What would be one actionable tip? So if someone's listening and watching think, I want to go to Edinburgh Fringe next year, what's one actionable thing they can do for their show or their brand today?
Do lots of research. I came to the Edinburgh Fringe to experience it before I bought a show. I would say do that, because I think there's a lot that you don't know just going into it. So it was great to go 1 year and just soak it all up, take it all in. I would recommend that. But if you're not doing that, just talk to as many people as you can, hear about all their different experiences, start early, just information gathering stage. There's a lot of information to gather.
And before I let you go, where can people not only see your show here, where can they find you online, social media? For free. Put it on the tiny chair, maybe.
Put on the tiny chair.
Oh my gosh, so, I feel like I'm a news presenter.
Furniture Boys is on every day, 2:30 p.m., Underbelly Bristow Square. Get your tickets now. They're selling out fast. We would love to have you there. And you can find me and Furniture Boys on social media at Emily E. Weitzman. Furniture Boys.
Edinburgh Fringe is a playground of new work. It's an exciting space to be. There's a great atmosphere. And I'm currently with a writer, producer, and actor of a show, Corey. So, Corey, this is your first time at the Fringe. Tell us about your show.
This is my show, Behind Closed Doors, and it's a semi-autobiographical piece about toxic gay relationships and kind of drug addiction, violence between people, and the kind of fight between love, keeping you together when things get hard.
Obviously, first Fringe, and you thought, I don't just want to act. I'm going to write. I'm going to produce. How has it been juggling those three hats?
It's been tough on my head. I've got great friends and family around me who've all stepped up to kind of to help, because if not, then I wouldn't be able to cope. It's been really challenging. Producing in itself is like the job of six people. So when you've written it and you want to do things about the writing and then producing, and then you're trying to get in the character and stuff, it's been really challenging. But thanks to the amazing team and friends I've got around me, we've smashed it.
Talk about the creation process. I think sometimes people think Fringe and they're like, oh, I'll just whack something on for this year. But obviously, often that's not the case and maybe not advisable. What has the journey been like with the show? And also, you've been to some other Fringes beforehand.
Yeah, for writing the show, it actually started, I tracked him off Westminster Bridge and was sectioned. And one of the kind of therapy techniques they gave me was to write my autobiography from birth. And whilst I was sectioned, one of the therapy techniques that they gave me was to write my autobiography of my life, to kind of try and process things I've been through. And during that time, Baby Reindeer had came out. So I thought, well, this could make something out of this. It's quite an interesting story. And I think it's a story that doesn't really get a lot of light on, especially with two men.
Yeah.
And from my experience, was quite dismissed multiple times. So I'm glad that we've started loads of conversations and we made a bloody good show.
And I think The Fringe has a... takes back the curtain a lot. It's quite an intimate anyway, because obviously a lot of the audiences are closer in the spaces. So it's probably going to be really rewarding for people to see it as well. And obviously looking at lived experiences for you as a creator. And it's that whole idea does like, because we're performers, it bleeds into our own personal time. So how has this been taking up quite a lot of capacity as well, creating the show, but also maybe therapeutic in its own right?
Yeah, it's definitely been therapeutic. And I love the business side of stuff. I've definitely got like a half business brain, half drama, creative brain. Working full-time to fund it alongside was really tough, and that took a lot out of us.
Well, luckily you said business, because this is the business, show business. So what business skills have you had in play for a show here? Or maybe finances, logistics, marketing, what have you had to do?
Before, after I graduated, I did a lot of work in hospitality, managing bars and venues in London and in the Northeast. So I've had a lot of those skills that have really helped. And I think that's maybe what a lot of people are missing at this kind of fringe shows and not realising how much it costs. I think I'm quite well-versed in business, and I still made some massive mistakes and had some massive black holes of money. So it's like preparation. You can't prepare too much for it. And like, we've got a line budget, line by line of everything now. And our producer Daniel's kind of given me a lot of guidance on that. He joined the project a bit later, so it's been a juggling game, but we've got there. And it's been, it's tough.
And
it's expensive.
What has been maybe the one thing that surprised you budget-wise then? Was you like, oh, this would be fine, and then you got here and you're like, food's so expensive? Or like, if you had to say to one person, have a bit more coin in your purse for this one thing, what would it be?
Before we came, it was the accommodation. We've managed to get a really good deal with through a friend who has a flat here, so that's been great. But the accommodation for like a room, it's over £1,000 a week in the university, sharing with other people. So that's just crazy money. And then when you're budgeting for the director to come up and the actors to stay, it's crazy. That's why we specifically only have two characters in this play, and one of them was me, to save as much money as possible. But I also think it's been great kind of working to the challenge of being a two-hander. Food and the cost of a pint, like a lot of people networking, though, like as silly as that is, a network and going to meet reviewers and critics and whatever else, you do have to go for a beer and buy your friends who are in a show beer, and it's like £8 a pint, and that's just unsustainable to kind of, so
I think working to a budget is probably one of those skills that creatives don't, because we're like, we love what we do, but actually it needs to be grounded, because otherwise if you can do anything, you do nothing. And you obviously live a little bit further out, not far at all, obviously still maybe like, what, 3 miles away, did you say?
Yeah, about 3 miles. We cycled in this morning, which is why I'm always sweaty.
It's very sporty, very sporty. But also probably quite nice, because you can decompress maybe after a show. You can go home and you're maybe not in the constructive chaos that is.
We're luckily not in the main hustle and bustle, which has been nicer to kind of decompress, because we've got a bit of a walk to get anywhere after the show. But yeah, we're staying in a nice area, it is out of the way, and we're right by the sea, so I elect to swim in the sea, so I think I'm going to start doing that after the shows to kind of get out of the zone because it's heavy.
Yeah. We were talking off camera about how the get-in time is roughly 10 to 15 minutes between the show before you and the show after you. Mm. How is that challenge as a performer? Because obviously, the content matter of the show, you're in a headspace, and then you've also got to build this world quite quickly. How is that kind of handover?
It's a Z. We've got like a happy, clappy musical show before us, and that ends at 3 o'clock on the dot. Their audience have to leave, which takes about 4 or 5 minutes. Then we've got to get in, blow up an airbed, dress the stage, and then get in the zone for his most mentally challenging character you could think of. It's tough, but it's kind of all part of the fun of it, I think.
Yeah.
And it is exciting, and not knowing if it's going to go right, there's always, you never relax at the Fringe, I think.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of part and parcel of it.
Before I let you go actually get ready for your show and your 15-minute window to build a set, you obviously did a few Fringes beforehand. Why or how important is it maybe that there are spaces then that you can try out new work, whether that's for a long run or short run? Do you think everyone who's maybe got an idea for a show, is it worth them maybe trying to put pen to paper and trying to hit up a Fringe?
I think definitely writing something is great, and showing people what you've written is really helpful, and people are really willing to read stuff and give you feedback. I think a big thing for me was learning not to take everything too personally. It's not like a criticism of you. It's just like it could be they're trying to better you, and I'm a lot better at that now, I think. thanks to Jason's help. I think just definitely do something. Otherwise, you'll never do it.
Yeah. Okay, so if you had to quickly give one piece of advice, if someone's watching or listening, and they an actionable piece of advice, if they want to be at Fringe 2027, what would that one thing be?
Start saving and start planning now before it gets any closer. I left some things too late and it caused a string of chain reaction problems.
Yeah.
So do it now while this Fringe is still on. Registration opens in closes in April and opens in this year, I think, October maybe.
Yeah.
So you've got plenty of time to kind of prepare and save as much money as you can.
Perfect. Straight down the barrel, tell us, what about your show? How long is it on for and how can they get tickets? Yes, flyer, go.
My show is Behind Closed Doors. It is a two-hander about a difficult, toxic gay relationship and the challenges faced with addiction and caring for someone with mental health problems. It is at Venue 41, the Alba Theatre, and you can get tickets at edinburghfringe.com, edfringe.com, or at Brawl Venue website. Start at 3:15 every day from now until the 30th of August. See you soon.
So the Edinburgh Fringe is a playground for new writing and a place to test out your work. So I'm here with Rachel to find out some tips and tricks if you are bringing your show or want to bring it next year. So Rachel, first of all, elevator pitch. What is your show? What is it about?
It's a car crash character comedy show about a woman who wants to become the mayor of Coulsdon. She's never had a job and she's got some quite dodgy views.
And what's the name of the show?
And the show is called Your Choice, Amanda Royce.
What has the creative process been? Because you sometimes see shows that have come up with an idea, they throw money at it and they come within a couple months and maybe they need a bit more time to incubate. And then you get maybe some people that, I'll go next year. And then it's like 4 years later. What has your creative process been?
I've been doing the character in short snippets and stuff online. And then a theatre director that I know came up to me and she was like, when are you just going to make your own show? And it seemed so obvious when she said it, but I'm kind of a bit allergic to one person shows sometimes if I don't know why the audience is there and what the relationship is. So when I decided that my character Amanda Royce should try to become the mayor, it was obvious why she was talking to the audience. And then over the course of 18 months, I would meet up with the director and we would devise the material. And it was kind of a sort of verbatim process where I would improvise and then we would shape the script like that.
Was it helpful to have that accountability partner? Because again, sometimes when we do what you love as a performer, it's maybe sometimes to put those parameters in. So working with the director, was it quite nice to maybe have parameters?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I was definitely hitting deadlines much better and also pushing myself to just make the show better and better. Yeah. Like, two heads is definitely better than one.
You mentioned obviously social media and some people love it, some people hate it, but it's a necessity now, especially in the creative sector. First of all, did you have any friction when making this character online? Did it help you? And then B, was there any friction then going the other way, taking it from something that was lived online and then rooting it in something that's on stage?
I suppose if Zuckerberg wasn't involved, I would kind of love that. Yeah. But he's the slave lord.
He's a fan of you. He's a fan of you.
Yeah, well, probably. Yeah, although I haven't got any followers. I'm going for a quality, not quantity on the followers. And actually, I have seen a couple of big influencers doing their shows this year, and it doesn't relate to bums on seats necessarily, which is quite interesting.
Yes.
That people will watch stuff online and in short bursts, but they won't want to watch it for an hour or part with their money, perhaps. So I suppose it's kind of a necessary evil, but it also, you know, it unlocks doors for lots of people. And it's amazing that you can sit in your bedroom, think of something funny and just post it immediately.
As an actor, you've obviously created this character, so you've created your own IP, your own world, your own brand with it. Has that been quite nice then as an actor when you're like, you know what, this is all my creation. I can set this world that it's in. Has that been quite a nice experience for you?
Yeah, definitely. I've been on a couple of research trips to Coulsdon in Surrey. The people there were very welcoming.
They're like, our leader, she's here.
Yeah, I didn't tell them I was running for mayor. I was doing some sort of stealth research. I suppose she sits in a sort of like absurdist world, which is next to the world. Like it's in the Count Binface and the Farage kind of disaster zone of politics at the moment. But yeah, it's been fun thinking about how far I can push it, and audiences get different jokes depending on how they've responded. Because it's quite a wincy show where I can see people's bum cheeks lifting them off the air.
And obviously, you've been here as a spectator to The Fringe, you're now performing. Is the show set, or each week, depending on if there's laughs in certain places or reactions, is there any level of flex, or you're like, this is what the product is this year?
No, there are moments. So there's bits where I ask people what they're worried about, and that changes to depend. I have no idea what they're going to say to me. It could be dog poo, it could be climate change, it could be, you know, bins. And that's quite fun. That's me just sort of improvising in the moment, like trying to think of policy ideas or... and there's also, there's quite a lot of call and response in the show as well. And some audiences are really up for it, and then some are like, no, we don't like this.
Yeah.
So it's different energy to the different crowds, but that's what's amazing about Edinburgh. And most people are really up for it.
And obviously, you've literally got to dash off shortly to the venue behind us to do your show. Maybe what's one thing you didn't realise as a performer bringing a show to The Fringe? Or is there any advice you have, like, save for Jesus or the money, or market early, make loads of flyers? Any advice or anything you maybe didn't know you needed?
Yeah. Someone gave me an amazing piece of advice, which was write a list of things that you want to achieve. And it can be just two things, or it could be 10 things. And you might get further down the list and it might get to like dream ticket items. But the first one is to get to the end and to just like enjoy the ride. So I think, be really strategic about what you want out of it, because not everyone's Fleabag. So that, you know what I mean?
Yes.
That's kind of nuts.
There was an interesting panel I was listening to, and they were saying that I think some people look at Fringe now through the lens of Fleabag or Six the Musical, and they're like, that's it. When hopefully someone will be that unicorn and it happens. But actually, it's probably just a great space to test out your work, meet other people. Has it been good for you to network at all?
Oh, I think I've made some new friends here, which is also great, like moving in different circles and meeting more comedians and... Yeah, it's great fun. And you know, if you want to meet your heroes, this is the place to do it.
And I guess also it's nice to know that there's other people in the same space as you right now.
Yeah.
It's almost like
and
that
everyone's so supportive here as well, in terms of like, you've got a WhatsApp group, people are like, I've got press in today, can we like fill up the seats and stuff? And I feel like if I asked someone for any crazy item that I needed, someone would be like, I've got it.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's get your phone. Yeah. Let's request something now. Exactly. Crazy one. What can we get?
See how fast.
Quickly, advice on maybe if flyering, yay or nay at The Fringe, or do you think you need to do more groundwork leading up to it, whether that's social media, get in touch with PRs, or are you working with a PR at the moment?
I do have a PR. Yeah, she's amazing. And I'm lucky that I'm her only client.
Yes. If she's exclusive, I need the mayor.
Exactly. Yeah, she works for the council.
No.
I think lots of people told me that you need to create a buzz before you even get here. And I did four London previews. And just tried to get as many of the people that I know to tell people that they know. And then, you know, someone's like, oh, my neighbor who I used to live on the road with 10 years ago is coming to the Fringe. And they're like, okay, well, they know someone who's got a show, so they'll come.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of everyone's sort of up for it. So it's great. Like, just don't be ashamed. Don't be afraid to ask, I think.
And life after Fringe, do you have plans? What's next? Back to online skits, stage show. Tell us.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love future life for the show. Yeah. I'd like more people to see it, especially people across the country. It would be interesting to see what different contexts.
To take your borough political... globally.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Amanda for Prime Minister. So different audiences and just, yeah, keep developing it. I've got in the back of my mind, I want to do the show about her husband.
Ooh.
So there's kind of a, it's kind of a sequel. It's very expensive, so and I guess just start saving.
Yeah, we'll do a GoFundMe or whip around after.
Yeah.
As we know, it can be hard work keeping yourself accountable, getting a show from pen and paper to actually live on stage at the Edinburgh Fringe. So I'm here with Alex from Kick It Anywhere, who is a driving force behind the Jolly Fisherman. So Alex, how is your Fringe going so far?
Thanks for having us, Jamie. Having a really good Fringe. I'm actually back in London very briefly, but I'll be going back up at the end of the month. And John, my co-founder at Kick It Anywhere, the writer of The Jolly Fisherman, is up there the whole month and making sure that Alex and Johnny, who are the two performers, get everything they need to get through the sort of 25 or 26 shows that they've got to do. And I think between us, we've had Edinburgh on our kind of horizons as something that we wanted to do and hopefully conquer for a long time now. And at the halfway point, or just about the halfway point, we're feeling very, very lucky to be having such a good run so far, yeah.
What was kind of the starting point for this year? Then, like, this is the year we're doing it. We're taking the show there. What was kind of the springboard?
It's a good question. I probably first went personally when I was maybe 13, 14, and just fell in love with the way that theatre and comedy and performance just totally takes over the city. And I reflect on it with people now who haven't been, that it feels the closest place in the world to Glastonbury, other than Glastonbury, where the spirit of performance and creativity is just sort of totally all present and all consuming. And it wasn't until maybe 2 or 3 years ago that John and I, as either half Kick It Anywhere, were getting into the sort of swing of writing together, doing your kind of arts council R&Ds, setting the company up and establishing ourselves in London. And we had a run Brixton Calling last summer at Southwark Playhouse, which was our first sort of full-scale professional production. And we were so blown away by kind of how that was received critically by audiences, really sort of happy with the run. And we're looking out the back of that as sort of what's next. John had been working on the Jolly script, which was kind of getting ready towards the back end of last year. And we both sort of looked at each other and thought, feels very Edinburgh. It's a two-hander. It's light on its feet. It's politically very salient. It's kind of got a great kind of high concept sell to audiences. So we just sort of held our breath and jumped. And we're very pleased that we did, I think.
And it's nice to hear that there's almost tick boxes or a slight strategy there. In fact, it does. It's a light, so it's two people, less money than sending a cast, say, of 12 up there. The fact there's obviously political nuances that are maybe very topical. So there's a slight criteria there. But in a business style, can you pitch the show to me in a 15, 20 second business pitch?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the first thing to say is it is a story of two childhood best friends set in East London, and one is British working class, one is British Pakistani, and through their eyes and through the lens of their friendship, we see how Barking is changing, and the kind of crucible for that change is the pub, the Jolly Fisherman, which closes down and a few years later reopens as a place of worship, specifically as a mosque. And so there was a lovely line in one of the reviews that said, this is about a pub in Barking, but it's also about Britain. But I think what we're most excited about beyond the story is the team we've managed to build. So we've got Leila Madnat directing, who's worked at the RSC, the Young Vic, the Almeida. She's an absolutely brilliant director. And then Alex Hill from the Fringe phenomenon, I would say, Why I Stuck a Flat in My Arse for England, and Johnny Khan, who was most recently in the Olivier nominated The Shithead. So a really brilliant kind of team, backed by light, sound, set, costume, fantastic team that are bringing it to life.
How early doors do you start assembling a team? Obviously, so you've got your writer and your scripts forming. What are the steps? Is it more additional producers, finding the venue, casting? What is maybe a time frame when you are creating a show?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think John and I both would say that at the very heart of our philosophy and at Kick It Anywhere's philosophy is the people we work with and the team we build. We both read a brilliant biography of Lin-Manuel Miranda last year, and it's sort of the crux of that was every project is an opportunity to work with new people and learn from new people, and you have to create these like cultures of kindness to make the best work. On this show specifically, we probably got confirmation that we were going to take it up to Underbelly at the start of this year, so January, February time. And immediately, I mean, the central kind of characters are so evocative in the script that we had an idea of who we wanted. And one of those was Alex Hill, who we were good friends with, big fans of the show. But we knew there needed to be an equally sort of powerful and charismatic British Pakistani actor. And we knew as well that we needed a kind of director who could bring the story and bring those two characters to life in a really sensitive and meaningful way. John's actually on the London Library Emerging Writers Scheme, and they were incredibly helpful at helping us sort of narrow down our lists for that second character and for the director. And we probably locked the team around sort of April, May time, I would say.
Is there a pitch deck when you're trying to find your venue up at Edinburgh Fringe? What is that process like?
So you mentioned earlier this idea of being a bit strategic, and I think the experience of setting Kick It Anywhere up, taking the show that we did last year to Southwark, really understanding what it means to make excellent theatre, but commercially successful theatre, was very helpful. And so we went into Fringe knowing that we only really wanted to do it if we could land the show at one of the big venues, just because of how much of an asset that is in landing your show, marketing your show. And Underbelly, Pleasance, Summerhall Assembly, those types of brands, to their great credit, have very, very clear timelines, processes, application sort of guidelines. And that was really sort of November, December time last year, as you're submitting the script, your idea for the show, your marketing of the show. And you get an answer very quickly in the new year as well.
And with that strategy and obviously all the pieces, you mentioned marketing there, which is obviously all you have to do is step one foot on the Royal Mile and it's posters, flyers. Yeah. What has kind of been your marketing strategy? Have you kind of done stuff in the lead up at all? Do you have a PR, or is it kind of more on the ground once your show kind of got up there?
Yeah, it's a funny one. So we have had a tight budget for the show, for sure. I won't need to tell you or anyone listening that the Fringe is economically very difficult. But we knew straight away, as well as getting the right venue, that we were only going to do this if we could put the money behind getting people in to see the show early. Like, we trusted the word of mouth once people were in, but those first few shows and generating the buzz to fill them was just so critical. We worked on Brixton Calling with a brilliant PR called Diana Whitehead from 4-4 PR, who very kindly came on board for this project. Doesn't usually do that much Fringe, but came on for this and secured us. I think the biggest boon we had on our marketing PR front was being in the Guardian's must-see list. So before we'd even started rehearsing, we'd sold hundreds of tickets, which was just massively beneficial. And happily, they had kind of front-loaded. And so we really then got into the rhythm of people coming early, word of mouth spreading. And another place I think we were quite strategic is we made a decision to be in a slightly smaller venue than perhaps we thought we could sell, because you know what Fringe is like. That sort of sense of buzz around a show from a show being sold out early can just carry you through sales and through the run. And we've seen that. We're pretty much totally sold out now, and we'd sold out quite, I think, the first half of the run before we even started.
Amazing. And like, that level of strategy and pre-planning allows you to kind of relax a bit, gives you a bit more capacity, so when you're on the ground at Ed Fringe, you can then focus on the last half or what's life after. What's one thing wish you had known about taking a show to the Fringe that wasn't really clear until you started this process?
I think you know anecdotally how costly it is, how financially expensive it is, but it's not really until you're doing it that you quite appreciate the realities of that and just how tight every decision is. We probably at the start of the process were a little bit loose on a couple of items of budget and kind of came to feel that as the year progressed. And I mean, to be totally transparent, we're going to sell out the run and we will not make money. We will lose money on the run, but we have made a decision that And this is a relatively light show, two-hander, not massive set, costume light, 70-seater. Like, we made a decision that that is an investment in the future life of the show, the future life of the company. But I would say to anyone thinking about it to go in as far as is possible with your eyes really open on cost and things that you perhaps just don't think about early enough. So we probably came a little bit late to the question of accommodation, for example. And it's, as you will know and your listeners will know, it is a very, very difficult city to find good and affordable accommodation for the team. And then you're getting into the things nearer the run where you're saying, well, actually, we would like our site, our sound, our light, and our set and costume designers to be up there for previews. We'd like our director to be able to see the first few shows. So we're investing in the notes process and making the show better. But every single one of those decisions is adding hundreds of pounds to a budget that's already basically stretched to its limit.
And what I really enjoyed earlier on when you said about the strategy of finding a venue and that scarcity, because as you said, selling out is such a fantastic thing to have at the Ed Fringe. And sometimes it's better to have a smaller venue than think, right, I need this massive 180-seater, but actually you're not selling out or filling up until the end of the run once those ripples have happened. So I think that's a really good takeaway from anyone listening.
The bar now to taking a show and taking a good show is so high, but the benefits of doing so are also so high. Like, we've been so struck by the extent to which, far beyond anything that we noticed when we did a show in London, like, the whole industry is there, right? Like, everyone who is anyone who should see your show, if it's going well, will come and see your show or want to get into your show. And so the single most important thing is that the show is good every day. Everything, every decision you make has to serve that. And have a great month otherwise, particularly if you're a performer in the show. But you can totally run away and say, I'm going to go and see five shows, I'm going to drink with my friends. And then you'll get middle of the month, and you're exhausted and the show suffers. And that really important person who was seeing it on that random Tuesday in the middle thought, actually, no, that wasn't worth the hype. I'm not going to think about that anymore, because you let the standard drop for an hour or 2 hours or what have you.
So you've been making circus for over 20 years. Yeah. Why do you think Ed Fringe is a great place for physical theatre and circus?
It's just the biggest collection of it. You know, there's is in a way, this is where the most educated audiences are. Like, that sounds very like we're only making it for people that know what they're seeing. We're not. It's we're introducing people to circus and different ways that circus can work and think different art forms that circus can cross into. But yeah, people. There's so much knowledge about circus here, and there's so much circus that people understand what's happening with it, and there's circus coming from other countries. So there's such a melting pot. And I think over the years, people, you know, it's so established, there's a circus hub, there's all the different companies are programming different work, different kinds of circus work. So I think the audiences are really aware of what they're seeing and have a sense of circus can be lots of different things. So for us coming here, it's a chance to develop the shows and see what's working and what we can tweak, and it's an invaluable experience.
And obviously, not only are you having to grow your craft as performers, but there's the whole element now in the Fringe of flyer in, networking, all of that. How do you balance the physical and mental toll of that as well? And obviously, you've got lovely PR with Chloe Nelkin as well. Do you have to kind of add that into the whole smorgasbord of the Fringe?
I mean, we are, because the show's very demanding and it's just the two of us in it, we've got a street team that are doing the flyering for us this year. We're also up here with our daughter. The show's partly about the experience of touring with a child and how that's worked for us as a company. So we're up here with our daughter. So we haven't been doing the flyering this year, which makes me sound very diva-ish. But it's been really, the flyering team have been brilliant, and they've been out there pounding the streets for us. So thank you to them. It is so important. We're concentrating on the word of mouth thing. We are, you know, when we're out and about, we've got our flyers in our hands and we chat to people in the street. Quite a few people have come up to us that have seen the show, and that often starts a conversation. And, you know, in that moment, there might be other people that hear and come up and say, oh, I've heard about that. And so it is just about getting the word out there. It's not easy.
And obviously, word of mouth and recommendation is
with any product, even if you're trying to buy a Hoover now, you'll look at a review or something like that. So do you think it's quite important for artists to maybe nurture relationships? Obviously, guard your energy. Don't go and be on the streets 18 hours a day. But do you think maybe sometimes we, in a world of social media, we sometimes overlook the fact of just a warm conversation?
Yeah, I mean, our whole show is conversation with the audience. So we're trying to build that rapport with them, and then at the beginning, as they're coming in, we're making them feel comfortable and welcome and know that it's going to be that kind of informal chatty show. And then at the end, we're making that plea, as everyone does at the end of the Fringe shows, making that plea to kind of spread the word of mouth, go and tell someone else. If you can tell one person, then that encourages, if we can tell two people, we're going to build the audiences. So and the reviews on the Fringe website have been so touching for us. That's been the real thing this year, is a lot of people are going on writing after the show. We're getting some really lovely heartfelt feedback. So that's been really lovely.
And speaking of audiences, and obviously everyone's got an ideal client, what do you have in your marketing portfolio? And this might help anyone who's watching or listening thinking, I need to go to the Fringe. What should they have at their disposal, like when they're trying to pitch the show?
I think if you're pitching a show for Edinburgh, you want a really wide appeal. So not too age specific, I think, because there's, especially if you're not going for the late night stuff, if you're working, our show's on at 5 o'clock. So we want kids, we want families, but also the people with the money are the grown-ups in the festival. So we have people from, in their 80s down to bringing really little kids. I think our show's got an age advisor of about 8, but people are bringing really little kids. There's nothing in the show that's unsuitable. It's just, a bit of a kind of adult chat. So, but it's working for everyone. And I think if you, having that big appeal and just having something that, I mean, the poster is the thing that everyone talks about, isn't it? I think having an image that really catches the eye, something that captures your USP, that lets people know this is something a bit different, this is something that's interesting, this is going to be something a bit standout from the things that are this, because there's so much stuff that is very similar. So I think you find the little niche that sets you apart.
For more tips and tricks on the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, head over and find the Business of Show Business on social media.